that it talked about Elijah. It was Elisha in this case, I guess, and the man of God. They call him the man of God. And I remember how that struck my heart. And I said, Lord, I don't want to be any right reverend and most high reverend and all that stuff. I just want to be a man of God. A man. I think that's the best title in the world. That's better than any pope or any position you have. Just be the man of God. To recognize that you're a man of God. The man of God. God wants us to be men and women of Him. And when the world sees Jesus instead of us, we're not going to have any trouble winning Him to Him, because He's altogether lovely. There's a Volkswagen with lights on, OCJ 434.
Points where we black the armor. I know some have fallen under the load and some have become weary and well doing. But God has called us. And God, who is the author, is also the finisher of our salvation. And God sees the great vast harvest fields. And God would not call us for the task if He were not able.
I do feel very, very keenly in my soul this morning, and I know it's the Spirit of the Lord. I'm positive that it's the Spirit of the Lord. That, and it's so wonderful to feel it. I just feel that God wants to just come in by His Spirit as a great spiritual physician and just heal everybody. Now, I'm not primarily talking about physical healing, although of course He wants to heal physically, but I mean a spiritual healing. I mean He wants to take out all that stuff that the enemy has put in us, you know. The enemy has put a funnel in our ear, you know, and he's dumped a whole lot of stuff in there. And he's put glasses upon us that don't fit. And we're seeing everything all fuzzed up, and we're seeing things all distorted. He's put kaleidoscopes to our eyes, and I'm afraid that to a lot of people that if they could stand on heaven's shore and look back and see themselves standing there and see truth and see the plan of God and see the heart of every individual and see what's been going on, the cries and the pains and the hurts and the hearts and everything, and then see what's in the minds. I am sure that if we could come back then and re-enter that body, that we'd be in a completely different frame of mind, don't you? I don't know if you can relate to what I'm saying like I can this morning, because I feel it so keenly. You know, here's two brothers over here, and they've hurt each other. And Brother John says, Lord, I don't know. I'm about ready to throw in the towel. Brother James has hurt me and he's always attacking me. Brother James has said these things, they're just not true. And I try to help him and I try to do these things and I try to explain to him. And I guess there isn't much use, Lord. Please change Brother James, Lord, or let's get me out of here. Brother James is down praying, Lord, I love you, Jesus. Lord, you know the trouble that John and I have been having. John put much pressure on me. He's so defensive, he always attacks me. Lord, I'm about ready to give up with Brother John, Lord. But if there's any way of saving him, Lord, you know? And they're both praying. They're both wanting to somehow solve things, and only God is the great solver. And you know, we come to a place when man tries. A man does have to try. He does have to try. But after he talks, after he prays, and after he tries to get through, and the other tries to get through, and he tries to see himself, and they get done and they're still apart, then hopefully as they pray, the Spirit of the Lord will bring them to a place to say, well, Lord, in your good time, I don't mean your predestined time because you wouldn't want to do it now, but Lord, as you kill your spuddle and things develop, it'll all get ironed out. In the meantime, we just love and accept one another and get off the bandwagon and join arms and hug and go on with complete misunderstanding. We just hug and go on because there's nothing else you can do, because God will bring that unity of mind if we hug and go on, but not if we kick and go off. So I just feel this morning, just to admonish all of you, I don't know how many people here are in situations like this with husbands and wives and families and relations and friends and foes and all the rest. But I do know that God wants us to hug and go on. He wants us just to lay our burdens upon the Lord. He wants us just to bless if we can help somebody else mend their net, why, we do that. And if they say, get out of here, I'll mend my own net, then we don't try to mend their net. We knock at doors, but we don't knock them down. So we make mistakes, but then hopefully we learn. Have you ever battled something till finally it got through to you? That there's no sense to keep banging yourself against it because nothing's happening. So then hopefully we learn to go around it instead of keep banging against it. And that's what we have to do in the Christian walk. But before we continue with the Sunday school lesson on making the crooked places straight, and that's what Jesus has done. He's come to make the crooked places straight, and I'm glad of that. Because in the natural, like the proverb says, the crooked places cannot be made straight. But then, with God, all things are possible, Jesus said, so then he comes to make the crooked places straight. And you get hemmed in, like the Greek says, with the Apostle Paul, hemmed in so that you're without a way, then Jesus comes and makes a byway. He makes a way where there is no way. And that's the wonderful thing about God, is when you get to a place where you see no way, you can look up and say, Father, I have looked at this from every angle. I have investigated my heart and my capabilities. And I know the principles. But Lord, I know that there's no way out. I know I can't give up this. I know that this is too important. I'd almost rather die first. And I know that we can never get through this impasse. But Lord, I also know down underneath that you can make great big ropes go through an eye of a needle. And Lord, that you can do anything. And Lord, I know that you are the problem solver. And that you are not so limited that you cannot find a way through this. So I'm believing you because you are the changer of hearts. You're the changer of lives. You did a pretty good job in Tall of Sauces on the Damascus Road. You've done a good job in a lot of drunkards and a lot of dope addicts and a lot of atheists. And Lord, I know you can certainly do a good job in some saints trying to get through. Amen. One person I have confidence in, and that's God. Now, I'd like to make a warning to you. I'd like to make a little bit of a reprimand. I don't know who applies to, and I don't care. But it applies to different ones from time to time. Now, I don't say this because we're weak in this assembly, in this area. We are probably one of the strongest churches in the nation in this area because we've taken care of the matter pretty well. But we're still people. And we have new ones coming in, and old ones tend to sometimes kind of fall back in old ways. But it's important, and we're going to have to every so often you get your lines out and you've got to regroup. And that's what we've got to do here. We've got to be careful that we don't pass on any information that is not verified. And we've got to make sure that we listen very closely to what's being said. And listen very closely to all the words. Scott Hartley said something in one of his classes one time, beginning of his class, and I didn't say anything to him, but I thought to myself, that is so basic That belongs in kindergarten, not college. Why would he bring such primary principles, waste class time, and bring something so basic that anybody ought to know that? But you know, I found out that he needed to say that, and now I'm saying it. And I really appreciate him saying it, because what I didn't know that he knew is he had a little closer plug-in with some of these brand new minds that didn't know how to think. And I guess I didn't realize how low of a level the Homo sapien could be at. But he said, now try to listen to what I am saying. I thought everybody did that when it's a kingdom class. And try to understand what I am saying. Listen to the words I use and connect the words I'm using to come up with the conclusion. Don't interject a lot of things into my words. I'm adding a little bit to what he said. And don't begin to assume upon my words. And don't begin to figure out what is he getting at and what's he trying to probably do. And ladies in particular, keep your ears open on this and that one. But rather, say, what is he saying? Because he is saying what he is trying to say. And I know a lot of people don't speak very precisely, and you have to do a lot of reading between the lines, but it's dangerous. But when you got somebody who does speak precisely, and he knows what he's talking about, be careful that you listen to what he is saying, because you can get so much information that he never said, if you don't be careful. Finish classes, and it's amazing what some people come up, and they come up and they'll re-quote you and say, well, you said so-and-so. They didn't say any such thing. I know exactly what I said. You added words because you were presupposing they were getting at that. But don't presuppose. Just take what we say, please. We know how to say what we want to say, and we'll leave out what we don't want to say. But listen carefully to what people do say, and don't embellish it. Don't add to it. Don't presuppose and then pass it on. That's not quite fair. And also, for some strange reason I don't understand, some people pass on information that don't even have a figment of truth to it. There isn't even no substance or basis to it whatsoever. And two cases in point. A certain person, elder, came to me and said that somebody was in confusion because they saw Mike Sabin. I got his permission to use his name. Because they saw Mike Sabin and some others up at the Space Needle, I think he said, and some other brothers, and they were all having wine together, dinner wine. And somebody else wrote a letter and then said they saw some people with wine, so they thought they didn't know whether it was right or all right, because other people were doing it. That's what prompted me to teach in that particular area. I called Mike up, and he was gone, but his wife was there, and I asked her if she might have asked her a question. And I asked her that question. She said, Mike didn't even drink before he got saved. He hasn't tasted a drop of it. And he'd never been out and had dinner wine with anybody. And I said, well, you're at the same table as somebody who didn't, because, you know, somebody might just, you know, assume, you know. He said, no. And another brother, another elder in this assembly, I guess he's not an elder, but another one of the teachers in this assembly, walked into, I think, a pizza parlor, and I don't know who the brothers are, but some of the brothers are around, and the information that I have is, the second information is that they serve, I think root beer or something, some kind of soft drink and some kind of a liquor bottle, whatever kind it is. And you know what it is, probably some of you know what it is. I don't know what it is exactly. But anyway, he walks in and sees these guys drinking soft drinks in a hard drink bottle or a liquor bottle as they were serving it. Huh? Well, maybe mug. I didn't think it was. But anyway, regardless of that, he says, hey, brothers, he looks around and says, let's flee this place. I mean, you realize what's going to happen. Somebody walks in and sees you sitting there with that. I mean, you know that your conscience is good, and you know what's in that, but does everybody else know what's in that? That's what you call avoiding even the appearances of evil. And they can lead the people, things like this, and you're sitting down, other people come in, and
and they order things, and you got to be careful of your associates even, and who you walk with. And then somebody came along and said, well, yeah, Mike Sabin saw this movie Jaws and said it's one of the best movies you ever saw. When Mike heard it, he about fell over in his shoes. He got in front of his class and said, I didn't see it, and I want everybody to know that's not true. And Marine Sabin was the one who volunteered information to me. Who told me, somebody said that, and told me who told him. I said, did you check back with the person? She said, no. And I said, well, you should. And you should find out who told that person. Get back to the source of it. And so I called that person. And the person said, yeah, I did say that. And I've learned my lesson, I guess, because I heard it from somebody else. And I don't remember who it even is now. But he said, when I heard Mike get up and say that, I thought, oh, no. He said, and I went around to everybody that I told. There was only two or three. He said, I went around to everybody. He said, and I told them. I straightened it out with them. And I said, well, I suggest you call Mike and straighten out with him. He said, yeah, I'll do that right away. And he said, I guess I've learned my lesson not to pass on unverified information. And he said, I didn't know. He said, I wasn't trying to down him anyway. So I just thought it was, I didn't know anything about it. And I thought, well, you know, if he says it's real good, why, maybe it must be all right or something. But I said, just know that most of that garbage out there is not all right. And one, don't pass on information that is not verified. Two, don't pass on information to somebody who doesn't have a reason to know it. Three, don't pass on information if there isn't a reason to pass it on. And four, if you get some information and you need to pass it on, verify it. And five, trace it back. Say, who told you this? So-and-so. And call them up. Say, did you tell so-and-so this? And if he says no, say, well, he says you did. And then you need to come to George Albert or somebody, you know, and say, well, now this brother is getting, you know, get the matter straightened out. And he says, yeah, I did. He says, who told you? Well, so-and-so. Okay, then we go to so-and-so. Trace it back to the beginner, to the beginning liar, say, and haul him up before the court. He said, did you? He said, yeah. I said, why did you? Well, I guess I was just in a bad, and so forth. All right, then we better get things down to the altar, straighten it out, and you better get up here publicly. And you better say, no, I've been lying against this brother, and I'm going to repent. And anybody who's heard this, it's not true. I started the story. You know, this is how you keep a healthy church. Now, if people will not trace back things and will not get things taken out, care of, and will not come to proper authority with them, things have a way of getting all messed up. And I'm going to give you direction. If anybody tells you something, you always ask them who told you. And if he says, I can't remember, then say, then I'm not going to remember. Goodbye. Say. Find out your sources. And whoever told you, did you verify it? Well, then why didn't you verify it? Now on, he said, well, I didn't know to. Well, now on you know to. Okay? Now on you know to. This is the only way we're going to keep from lies being spread about people and malicious things. That hurts somebody, you know, things like that. And you wouldn't want it told about you. Remember all the stories that are told about community chapel. And they're not true. Well, people have a way of telling stories about people, too, that aren't true. I discussed it with one told about me, too, just a while back, that I put somebody in a place and I didn't do any such thing. But be careful when you get information. I should trace it. And let's just be very, very careful here. And we can save us. So the devil's trying to split. He's trying to hurt us. And if we'll be careful, we'll defeat him. Well, we've talked about legalism, what it is and what it isn't. We've talked about grace, what it is and what it isn't. Now we want to talk about the spirit of the law. And I'm not going into any deep studies on these, but as I said before, there are people going around saying, oh, well, they're in legalism, or they're in bondage, or, well, I just go by the spirit of the law, brother, and you're, you know, living a sloppy life, and you reach across the... Do not steal the watermelons. No trespassing, keep out. That one is so close to the road, I can reach it right through the barbed wire fence. You reach in and you twist it off. Said, well, brother, you're stealing. Oh, don't be a legalist. No, it says you steal. That's not your melon. Well, he's got millions of them. I'm just going by the spirit of the law. No, you're not. you are violating the spirit of the law. Because the spirit of his law was, don't take my watermelons. There's a lot of people using that spirit of the law business. They got it so, you know, I preached on it, and that's the happiest gimmick they got. They always carry it in their pocket, wherever they go, the purse. They always make sure they got that spirit of the law thing with them, so they can haul it out and use it. It's just a real handy device. They had to trade in the old Lutheran when they used to have, when they came here. And the old Lutheran was, and of course it wasn't just belong to Lutherans either, it belonged to everybody else, you know, and Pentecostals too. And that is, that old handy button they used to put on every time somebody come up and say something, they'd pull it up and put it on, and it would say, judge not lest you also be judged. Okay. Well, we talked about that one for a while. And so now they got the spirit of the law when they slick on, see? Oh, don't be a legalist button, see? And I saw a card one time, and I made up a card. And I'm not much for these type of things, but I did it once. But mine was a different one. It only had one word in it. And somebody would come up, and they'd do something. I'd pull out this card and hand it to them and walk away. They'd come and complain or something, and it would stay on it, glory. That's all I said. My glory card, see? That was years ago in another church. But anyway, let me tell you what the spirit of the law is not. The spirit of the law is not loosely following the law. It is not bending the law. It is not modifying the law. It is not disregarding or discarding the law. It is not doing what seems justified to you, even though the law says no. It is not doing, that is, it is not, now you might be justified in doing something that the law says not to do, in some cases. But the spirit of the law is not doing what seems justified. Do you understand the difference? In other words, anytime you feel justified in disobeying the law, it doesn't mean that you are following the spirit of the law. It is not doing what one wants as long as you don't consider it real bad. Say, well, I'm just, you know, it's just not, you know, it's just a little, you know, little thing. So I'm just going by the spirit of the law, which means I violate it just in this, in the peripheral parts of it, and this is in small measures. But that is not what the spirit of the law is. It is not liberty to stretch the law. Well, then what is the spirit of the law? The spirit of the law is the actual intention of the law. The actual intention of the law. The actual heart and spirit behind it, that which produced it. That in which the person or persons were trying to get at when they wrote the law, that is the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law is God's heart. Now, this is talking about God's laws. God's heart of holiness and love and mercy. His holiness, that which is right, as well as mercy and as well as love, all what God is. The spirit of the law is following the best path, regardless of the letter of the law. I didn't say you can ignore it as self-interest when you feel like it, when you'd rather not, because you disagree with it, or because you consider it the best, but it is following the best interest if you know the spirit of the law. And you may miss on that. And whenever you decide to disregard the letter of the law on the grounds of the spirit of the law, you better make sure that you understand the spirit of the law, because you are guilty of disobeying that law if you have missed in your interpretation as to the spirit of that law. Now, in other words, following the best path, regardless of the letter of the law, is looking under the letter of the law at the heart of the law. Let me give you some examples. You're passing by a big estate,
a beautiful estate, and there's a big sign, no trespassing. And your three-year-old daughter sees a beautiful little pond with some swans in it, and it charges off across the lawn. And you yell, Samantha, come back here. And she doesn't come back. And she's headed for this deep pool. Now, you don't say, oh, I would sure love to run after her, but the sign says no trespassing. You say, well, the sign means I don't want people tromping all over my grass and flowers and ruining my estate. This is my property. But my daughter's liable to drown. And she's already trespassing, but she can't read. And I'm sure that if they were there, they'd give me out here on the walk, they'd give me permission to go after my daughter and stop her from falling in the pond. So I'll charge off across the grass and get my daughter. See, that's the spirit of the law, rather than obeying the letter of the law. Your child is walking, you and your children are walking down this unfinished building looking it over. And your child starts running off down the hall, and you'll see some exposed wires out there, and the power line's on, and some electricians go past it, and they're checking some things. And you know, high power voltage, and you suspect you're going to get electrocuted, but you look up in the wall, and it says no running. See? Well, you don't walk as fast as you can trying to get down to it, see? You come racing down that hall at top speed, no running signs or no running signs, see? That didn't mean don't try to save a life from getting electrocuted. It means if you run, you're liable to slip and fall or bump into somebody. But in this case, if you don't run, you're liable to kill somebody. Let somebody get killed. See? Laws, God's laws are made to save, not to hurt. And this is where all the problem came with the legalists and the Pharisees. They were all trying to say, well, wait a minute, now, this is the Sabbath day. You're not supposed to work. And there Jesus was on the Sabbath day and in the synagogue and saw a man with a withered arm. And Jesus went out and said, poor man, be healed. I want to heal you. I want that arm to be good. And they rose up with indignation. Well, what business is this man doing practicing medicine on the Sabbath day? The Sabbath day, the letter of God's law says, God says, don't work on the Sabbath day. But here, God, veiled in flesh, was healing somebody on the Sabbath day. And Jesus said, you hypocrites. And he had a right to say that because God knows all things and made man. He said, you hypocrites, you two-faced people. He says, I know how you keep the Sabbath. You've got a law that says that no man must carry more than the weight of one dried fig. You have even decided what is called work, and you've got it down to the finest of minute details. And so you say a man can drink vinegar on the Sabbath, but he can't gargle it, because gargling, drinking is eating, and gargling is medicine. So if you get a sore throat, you better drink it, but don't spit it back out. You got everything down to a fine-tooth detail. But what happens when your ox or your ass falls into a ditch? An animal can wear itself out in that deep ditch and go into a frenzy, and you can't go on without it, and you're stuck, and he's stuck. You know what you do? He says, I'll tell you what you do. You look down the road both ways to make sure no other Pharisees are looking. And then, forgetting that God is looking, you haul him out of the ditch. And then you walk along and find somebody carrying a basket of eggs, and you ball them out good and proper. Okay, it weighs more than one dried fig, which you made up. So that's what legalism does for you. And he said he was out there, and him and his disciples walked into a grain field, and they rubbed out some corn of wheat, began to eat it. And they said, well, they're all working on the Sabbath day. Now, Jesus knew when the Sabbath day came around, and he knew it was the Sabbath. And he wasn't in such a position that his stomach was growling so bad he couldn't stand it. He'd been peace fasting 40 days, tempted of the devil. I mean, he knew how to fast. He could go one more day if he needed to. But the point was, he was out ministering every day.
He didn't have a field of his own. He wasn't always taking time to eat. The crowds were constantly about him until he would go long hours because people were pressing upon him, demanding healing and everything else, until even his own family couldn't come to him to see him. And the crowds, the presses were enormous. And so being hungered with them and feeling like that they had ministered until they were tired and worn out and a little bit faint and they needed food to go on, and not being a legalist, he took his disciples in the cornfield, in the grain field, because he had already made a law that not to glean the corners of your field, but leave it for the wayfaring man. You're rich. God's given you the rain. He's given you the crops. He's given you the produce. He's given you the fertilizer. It's his plant. It's his seed. You're standing on his ground. I mean, and you get that great big field. Now, don't go up and get every dinky bit in the corner. Let the man who doesn't have anything come by and let him walk into your field and get that. Don't put a no trespassing sign up in the corner. Let him rub out a little bit for himself. Not come in with the whole crew and start harvesting what you've got, you know, just to cheat you, but to come in because he's hungry, because after all, God's given you what you've given, what he's given you, and part of it. Let him have part. Now, that's God's love. God decided that. And so Jesus was doing that, and he had a right to do what he was doing, but they didn't like the day he was doing it. He was trying to teach them something. He was trying to say, we don't operate by all your letter of the law situations. He said, didn't you read back what David did when he went into the, when he was being chased and by Saul, and he finally was famished, and he fell upon the tabernacle there, and he asked the priest for some bread, and all they had was some holy unleavened bread, and nobody was to eat it but a priest, and David wasn't a priest. But David was in a position of highly esteemed, and the priest gave him. He asked for it, and the priest gave him the unleavened bread, and he ate it because his body was really needing it. It wasn't just because he had gone 3 hours without a meal. I mean, you know, he'd probably gone closer to 30 hours without a meal or something. And they had never bawled David out for that because David was so great they wouldn't bawl David out for that. But they were bawling out the man of Nazareth for that. He said, haven't you ever read about that? I didn't know what to say exactly. He said, Sabbath day wasn't made to make it difficult for people. It was made to help people. So they wouldn't try to work themselves to death all around the whole clock and hog everything up and not let the land rest and not give time for God. I'm trying to show there's a time when you set yourself apart into God and receive spiritual rest even, as well as physical rest. And don't go all the time without it. And we needed it at a time, and we've been passing it up because of you. We've been ministering to you. And so we took it. And I knew you'd misunderstood it, but we did it just to be able to tell you about it, teach you a lesson, to show you. Besides the transition, the Sabbath day was about to be fulfilled in the spiritual Sabbath. Now, the spirit of the law is the opposite of legalism. It is recognized that the laws, as I said, was made to save, to help, not to kill, or to hurt. Now, let me give you some examples from Scripture. Did you know that Jesus lied? Did you know that God lied? Did you know that God told people to lie? Did you know that God condoned lying? You say, well, did he? Well, it depends on how you define the word lying. Taking in the usual sense of what we mean by lying, yes. And what we mean by lying is saying something that is not exactly true. But taking it in the concept of what I think God means, no, because God very definitely and positively says that he is not a liar. He's a God of truth. But the Scripture records the instances that we would record and we would regard as lying of God and Jesus in the flesh, God in the flesh and Jesus lying. Because he is going by the spirit of the law. Now, he made the law. He knows what the spirit of the law is. Why did he say don't lie? Why did he say don't lie? Well, because it wasn't true. No, that's not why he said it was don't lie. He said because you lie because you're going to take advantage of somebody else. You lie to take advantage, unfair advantage of your brother. The Scripture says, you say, it is nothing, and it's nothing. And when he goeth away, he boasteth.
That's the old marketplace thing. You pick it up and say, well, how much you want for this? 3 shekels.
Ah, what's 3 shekels?
It's not poorly done. You see, it's nothing, this little thing. It's just, you know. And then he finally haggles him down to 1.5 shekels. And he goes away and says, boy, what a steal I got. It's worth at least 20, see. And he goes away, he boasts. And that was an unusual marketplace situation. But normally it's even worse than that. You lie about things to hurt other people or to gain advantage for yourself. And most lying is for that purpose. But occasionally you're at a place where you need to tell something that isn't true, that won't hurt you. It's not take advantage of somebody else. It won't hurt anybody else. Nobody else has a right to that information, and it's asking to help the whole scene. And in that vein, it's not what God calls lying. We cover this quite completely in study of contemporary problems in Bible college. Let me give you one case. Now you know that a person lies not only by words but by actions, don't you? If you said, "Did I hit the pulpit?" But you did. Oh, I didn't say I didn't. Yes, I did. Because words are only symbols to mean something, and this means something in all language, and this means something in all language, and this means something in all language. Okay. And actions as well as words. Well, the Bible says that when Jesus came down to Peter's house, they were all coming together, Jesus made as though he would go further. And Peter invited him into his house. Now, Jesus knew that Peter was going to invite him in. So he could have just walked right into his house. He knew he was going to end up there. But as they came in, they began to veer out. You can see that now, can't you? They began to veer off to the door of the house, and Jesus began to go on. And they looked. I said, oh, Jesus. Of course, the concept at that time wasn't he is God, you know, but that he was of God. And that was a prophet of God, mightily used. And they saw him, you know, pretending like he was going to go on. And they called him into the house. Now, why did Jesus do that? Well, he didn't want to presuppose and force himself on somebody, like, I have a right to come in your house and eat your bread and all of that. You have a hard enough time with yourself, and I'm going to wait for an invitation. So if you didn't give me the invitation, which they didn't, they would assume that he'd walk in, he's going to go on. And because he was blessed with foreknowledge, he wasn't going to take advantage of that. And so he really told what a legalist would call a lie, inasmuch as he pretended to do something that he wasn't. He lied about his intentions. His intentions was going to go on. But I would never, don't go on and say that Don Burnett said that Jesus lied about his intentions, because I don't think he lied, because I'm interpreting the word lied like God uses it, not like we usually use it. But when I get through telling you these things, I'm not going to tell you the whole story. Right now, you're taking temporary problems to get all the whole story. If I would tell you the whole story, maybe say, this is just the kind of information I've been looking for. I can use this along with my judge not pin and my don't be a legalist pin, see. See. This is not a lie pin. But beware, God knows whether you're using that in the spirit of the law rightly or not. You say, well, how did God ever lie? Well, God blew in the tops of the trees in the Assyrian camp and made the sound of the leaves by bursts of wind to make it sound like chariot wheels. And they said, the Samaritans have hired the Egyptians against us, and they fled because they were walled up and they had them circled and they were starving to death. And God saved Samaria, Israel and Samaria, by that method. Now, that is a lie in the legalistic term, because he brought to them, to their mind, something by direct action which said that the Syrians were coming by bringing noise of chariots, pretending to have noise of chariots when there wasn't any. He said, well, how's that lying? What if you came in to your parents and they were saying, well, now, how come you walked all the way over the hill? And you said, well, you were wanting to paint the picture that you weren't walking over there. Somebody brought you over in a Model T. And so you had somebody, or maybe you call them on a phone, we'll say, it might be better. And so in the background, you were going, you said, well, I didn't lie to them. Yes, you did. You were trying to tell them that there was a car there with the motor running. I'm just ready to get in the car now. Can you hear it? See? But God did that. But he had a right to do it. In fact, he even told them to lay ambush against the city of Ai and then bring in a small group in front, and they'll think that's your army, and they'll come out of the gates to chase you, and they get chasing you, and then the others went into the gate. Well, what's an ambush? It's a lie. An ambush, and this part coming in says, this is all the people we got. But the rest are hiding down there. In fact, he told Gideon to lie because he said, in a legalistic term, take a pitcher and put a lamp in it because only and have your men have a trumpet. And come into the camp and break the light and blow the trumpet and shout. Because only the leader of every company had a bugler beside him. And only each one of them carried a lamp in front of his whole company because they all followed. Wherever the light went, the whole company followed. They didn't have 1,000 lights. That wouldn't do them any good. But every man having a light and only having about 300 men, they thought they had 300 companies out there. And they saw 300 lights and heard 300 bugles. And so he told them to deceive the people. And when Rahab the harlot told a direct word lie, when they came up and said, who are the two spies that came to Jericho? And she hit them in the flax. She said, oh, they just left. If you're her, you'll get them. But you're welcome to read in the book of Hebrews and it says, was not Rahab justified by her faith? Now, how was she justified? If you read the whole story, she was justified because she said, she told them, we have heard what Yahweh has done. And I now know that we in Jericho are following false gods who have no power, but you are following the true God, and he's got power, and I know that this city is going to be taken by you because nothing can stop you following God. Therefore, I'm going to cooperate with you. And they said, if you do that, we will promise you, and you put down a scarlet thread, and you betray your own city, and we'll see that your house doesn't get hurt and your family. And she went back and married a prince in Israel. And God blessed her and said, because she had faith in the God of Israel, even though she never even met him face to face. And so therefore, she even turned against the pagans and turned towards the God of Israel and lied, and God blessed her because of it, because they had no business cutting God's people to pieces, even being pagans in the first place. Reminds me of the case when this woman came in and the communists came into a house and were hunting for Bibles in a Russian-occupied country, or Russia, whichever the place was. And that she heard about it, and she was baking bread, and she stuck it through the Bible, and she stuck it in the bread dough, and put it over it, and stuck it in the oven. And when they came to her door and knocked, they said, they went to the house looking for Bibles, and they said, what's that you got in the oven? And she said, just bread. And she didn't say bread. She said, just bread. And they laughed, and she said, took it out, and she said, just the bread of life. Okay. Tyndale smuggled Bibles in cotton and so forth into England, or they would not have had the Reformation. Should they have done that? I mean, should they have lied? How far do you go? Well, God's saying that the enemy doesn't have a right to you to do this. Camouflage is lying. False code signals in wartime is lying. Spy systems in wartime is lying in a legalistic manner. And matter of fact, supposing you say, well, I don't believe in it anyway. And then let me give you a hypothetical question, and you might change your theology. Somebody comes, a maniac, twisted maniac, comes rushing into your home with a submachine gun. And he looks over and sees a child, one of your children on the bed, and machine guns him down. And he looks over and he sees your wife, and machine guns her down. And he looks at you and says, you got any more children in this house? And you've got one more in the closet. And if you say nothing, he'll know that you do, and he'll look and find it and kill that one. So either you lie or you don't. But if you lie, is it to hurt? or is it to help? What was the spirit behind the lie, this business of telling the truth? Does he have a right to that information from you? You see the difference it makes? A retarded child is coloring, and it colors, and everybody, and you look at the kindergarten class, and they're all kind of within the lines, but this one's all over the place, you know. Just scribbled all over the place. And you go along, and your first student says, oh, that's nice, honey. It's going to be color real good today. Stay inside the lines, you know. So, well, now it's nice. Oh, that's really nice. And you come to hers, and it is a mess. You look into those dull eyes and big, happy smile. You know there's a soul that's been hurt. My mother was possibly on drugs and maybe in venereal disease and other things, living in sin when that little poor innocent child was born, and his mind is deranged and it's been hurt, or maybe it fell as an infant or something. And you look at it and say, oh, that's nice, honey. And you hand it back and, oh, she just beams. You liar, you. Is that what you expect? Was it to hurt? What's the intention? You see, now, the spirit of the law, if you're going to understand the spirit of the law, you're going to understand God. It's not some Pharisee device for your own interest to get yourself out of some trouble so you can bend the law to fit your own flesh. And there's a lot of people been using it a little bit in the wrong way. And others will come along and they'll accuse. But you got to see things in a right perspective and know why God made said what he said and what the heart of the whole matter is. And I'll tell you, if I'm sitting down at the corner waiting and I see a stop line that says stop, and all of a sudden I look in the mirror and, like I said before, I see a Mack truck loaded with scrap iron with the driver slumped over the wheel headed down the hill right behind me in my rear view mirror, and I look, and there's no cars coming across that stoplight, and I can't turn into this lane because maybe there's some kids who are there on a bicycle or something, and I can't turn to the right because there's a ditch. I want to let you know I'm going to run right through that stop line sign as fast as I can get through it. And if somebody's coming to that stop sign and there's a lawn over the hill, I'm going to tear right through the old lawn and shrubbery and tear it all to pieces. Of course, all that State Farm paid for it. And if I'm headed for some little child on a bicycle, I'm going to run right through somebody's house and lawn, if I can, to keep from tearing that little child all to pieces. That's the spirit of the law. But you don't just say, oh, well, forget the law. I mean, you know, nobody around, nobody's, you know, so forth. These men with blue suits, you know, and stores here, they tend to be legalists. So realize that they don't always understand the spirit of the law. Well, let's talk about bondage. So all you people are all in the bondage. That usually happens by people when they've been corrected and they leave, you know. All community chapels are all in the bondage in that place. Bondage is not government. Bondage is not rules. Bondage is not cooperation and coordination. Bondage is not laws. Bondage is not submission. Oh, submission, submission, submission. See? That's like saying, oh, love, love, love. Peace, peace. Could be the wrong way. Oh, submission. Oh, submission. You don't want to... You know, authority. Great, big, ugly monster called authority. Yeah. I know what authority is. Authority is that loving heavenly father that loves you. It's that father that picks a little daughter up and says, sweetie, if you don't pick up your blocks, you're going to learn to be a bad little girl, and Daddy is going to spank you hard. Now, you're going to mind me. Now, you get down and pick the blocks up. That's authority. Authority is safety. Authority is help. Authority is God's plan. Authority isn't some big, ugly thing. Now, some people in authority may abuse the authority, but that is not what authority is. Authority is not pressure you feel to a lawful authority. Oh, authority, authority. I can't go over so fast. You gotta do this and you can't do that, and you're not allowed to do this, and you gotta do this and you gotta do that. Authority, authority, authority. I can't do anything I want to do, which means I can't even live in anarchy if I want to. I can't even live lawless. I can't even disobey all laws of God and man. I can't run unrestrained like a beast in the field. But God never said that you had a right to do that. God owns you and the field and the land, and you breathe in His air, by the way. And if you're going to stand on His property and breathe His air and use His equipment, well, then you must obey His laws. Even those fences you pounded around your property and put no trespass, and you say, my land, that's God's root tree you chopped down. That's His ground you pounded it into. And that's His material you dug out to make the wire. And that's His material you used to make the dye, even to say no trespassing, my property. And that's His tree you used to make your title deed, the ink you used to say my property on. And you're breathing His air while you're standing there. And you're planting His seeds and using His sun and His rain and His fertilizer. I mean, after all, He has a right to it. He decides. That same principle decides if God tells the people to go up and chase the Canaanites out of Canaan and let the American let the people go across and take the and occupy this land, even though there's Indian tribes living here and here. That same principle owns. God owns the land. He owns the cattle on a thousand hills, it says. And everything you think is yours is His, including you. He made you. You're not your own. You're bought with a price. You're headed for the gallows and He rescued you. What bondage is a lack of spirit of freedom. Lack of the spirit of freedom. You can even lack freedom and not be in bondage. You can be free in your spirit. You can lack, it's a lack of the spirit of God. Bondage is lack of victory over sin. It's a lack of freedom of choice. Not all these things necessarily, but it's one or more of these things, depending on your situation, if you're in bondage. Lack of victory over sin. Lack of freedom of choice. Lack of free moral agency. And you're bound by sin, meaning that you can't do what you want because there's another law that's put you in bondage, the law of sin. I just got to have a cigarette. Why? You're in bondage to the cigarette. You're in bondage to a 3-inch cigarette. That's right. He's your master and you bow before Him. You're bondage to the bottle. I can't quit drinking. I'm bound by this thing. You're bound to it. I've got to have drugs. You're bound by drugs. That's what bondage is. You can't be a free moral agent. You can't choose. Well, I decided not to smoke anymore. I decided not to drink. I decided not to use drugs. You can't decide that. That thing begins to pound on you. I decided not to sin anymore. That power of sin has taken hold of you. The devil's upon you. It's pressure from unlawful authority. It's pressure from someone who is without grace, or without love, or without balance. Now, it's not your definition of a balanced program. It's not your definition of if somebody understands the problem or not. But rather, it's pressure because somebody is not in a lawful authority and he's putting it on you, or he doesn't know how to use the lawful authority. He's abusing it. But be careful, again. Even if you had somebody that's abusing his lawful authority, he's still the authority. Remember that. And also remember, that's why people give themselves up as martyrs to the lawful government. If an insane man comes, I'll give you an example. You may not understand this, or agree with it, or so forth, but where I am and my thinking and understanding of all these things is this. If I'm walking through a back alley at nighttime trying to get to my car with my wife, and some big grizzly fella jumps out of the shadows with a hatchet in his arm, and he wants to chop me up and rape my wife and take her, I'm going to use everything at my disposal to knock them flat in the pancake. And that's right. Oh, you mean as a preacher, you would actually knock them down? Brother, would I? You mean to hurt them? No, not to hurt them. To keep them from hurting me and my wife. You mean, well, supposing you had an opportunity of using judo on them and you threw them and smacked down on the cobblestone and he hurt his back. It's a lot better than him going to prison for killing two people and being hung. He better be stopped in this thing before he kills a few other people. God made laws what to do with murders in the first place. Back there, kill them. So you see, it's for the best. It is for the best that he gets stopped, even if he bruises his body a little bit. But now, after you throw him down, if you grab a brick and begin to, and you can hold him until the police arrive, if you begin to take a knife or a brick and begin to get revenge on him, now you've crossed the line. Now your attitude is to hurt him instead of letting the lawful legal authorities be the judge of his punishment, and you decide to be the judge. You're not the judge. But you have a right to defend yourself. If he comes in and says, do you love Jesus? And he's a deranged man. He comes in and says, you know, he comes in and he's all, and maybe he's in drugs and drunk and all this, and unlawful authority comes in and do you love Jesus? And so I'm going to kill you. Get a knife in somebody's throat. I'm not against giving him wrong information until I can get a hold of him, get him to the police, and get him back to the padded cell. But if lawful authority comes in and the state comes in, I'll never deny Jesus to a lawful authority. Martyr me if you will. But see, that's the difference. And you can't fight the state anyway. You'll end up losing your life fighting the state instead of giving your life as a martyr for Jesus. But you don't owe that information to a deranged man. But because there is government and lawful authority, it is not up to every man to decide whether the government is right or you have chaos, anarchy, no submission, no authority. Because if everybody only obeys if they agree, that's not obedience. And if everybody in this land who's got different opinions all disobey the government, in every area they disagree in, what have you got? You got a mess. Authority presupposes that the person follows you whether they agree or not, up until a point that violates their conscience. And then you stand in jeopardy between you and God as to whether or not you did the right thing as far as violating the conscience is concerned or not. Well, I don't have time to go on to what freedom is, but we'll talk about that and some other things next week. Morning service will start in a few moments.